So in this general topic of anger, which I think I'm an expert at, I often think of anger as the problem. And I did this exercise yesterday. I looked in both the front section of the New York Times and the front section of the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, and I counted how many articles in each of those sections had anything to do with any of those words that I just read around anger or irritation or... And in the first section of the New York Times, there were 22. And in the first section of the Chronicle, there were 14. So that's a heavy hit on a Sunday morning. And so we get it reinforced, you know, this message around this energy over and over again. And really frequently we think about this as a problem. And we get these horrific events like this incident or this tragedy that happened, I don't know if people are aware of it, on the hockey rink, and there was an altercation and fight between two hockey players, and it erupted into this fist fight that broke someone's neck, and it was replayed over and over again on national news. And what I'd like to talk about is how our practice asks us to actually take the widest view of anger, and really not necessarily to view it as a problem or not a problem, but really to direct our mindfulness and awareness to what is our internal experience with it. What is our internal experience, whether are we actually mindful of the experience of anger or are we not? Anger is, in one way, can be just considered another form of energy. And one of the, I don't know, proofs that I've had of this is that when I'm upset or angry, I can't sleep. I mean, I'm up during the night, or my sleep is very light, and I'll wake up easily. So there's just a lot of energy within the experience of anger. And what the mindfulness practice invites us to do is, am I mindful of that energy and what impact that it has on me? Am I mindful of the vibration, of the heat, of the tightness and the constriction in my body? How is that affecting my emotions right now? All of these are not easy feelings. They're not pleasant. And so directing the mindfulness towards these unpleasant feelings in itself is difficult. And we resist it. We really don't want to be there. And we do a lot of things to push that experience out of our direct contact. We're actually not trained to be with anger. We're not trained to come close to it. But if we ignore it by, you know, judging ourselves or saying that we shouldn't be angry or medicating against it or looking for a pleasant experience instead of the anger that's presented to us, the energy still remains and it resurfaces over and over again. So we can't change or transform anything in our lives that we're not aware of. So this is where I've come to believe that the mindfulness practice is really beneficial in examining my experience with this energy. One of the things that that's helped me is to think of my experience with anger not unsimilar to my experience with a severe cold. When I am in that state of, you know, a high fever or a runny nose or whatever it is that I'm suffering from, there's almost nothing. There is no medication. There's nothing that I can do to make it go away. I actually have to ride that wave. So what is the best intervention for anger or a cold? Well, most doctors will say the best intervention for a cold is prevention. And really that's what our practice, our mindfulness practice, is inviting us to do around anger. is noticing, you know, what are those incremental sensations or feelings or emotions that may be tiny in the beginning, tiny annoyances or irritations, but they cascade into this much larger experience, this overwhelming experience of anger or rage. And the only way to prevent that kind of cascading is our mindfulness, is being aware, not getting to the extreme, but just noticing the path that we're on and choosing whether to be there or to choose something different. And this incremental work, you know, sort of noticing the details of our experience can really seem so trivial and ineffective. You know, it's like going back to the breath over and over and over again and not seeing the results. When I was in my 20s, I was a park ranger, and I trained as a, among other things, as a forest firefighter. And fire is a really close metaphor for anger. I mean, it's in our language. But interestingly enough, fighting fires is very similar to my experience in looking at and exploring anger. When I was in this class of forest firefighting, our final exam, there were 90 students, our final exam was that they torched 120 acres and we had to put it out. And so most of us were up for 72 hours straight. And some of us were on the front lines with the hoses, but most of us were digging fire lines. So we were digging in areas that were not burning. We were containing, and we were spraying water over vegetation that wasn't burning. And a lot of my time was spent with this 10-gallon. It was this bag with a sprayer, and they called it a piss tank because you just pissed on the forest fire. It was just this tiny little stream of water that seemed like this is not going to put anything out. And I'm sure that, you know, my little tank did not put it out, but the fire did get put out. And it was this incremental effort that that gradually accumulated around the fire to contain it, and it burned itself out. But a lot of times we get caught. We get caught in these sensations, you know, this blindness that sometimes anger or rage can give us. We can get caught in the story that we create around the anger, justifying it over and over again, making this really important situation in our lives. So recently, I'll just give you a mundane example in my recent experience. I have this financial piece of software that I upgraded, and all of a sudden I found out that my Internet Explorer was not supporting it. So I had to upgrade that piece of software with Microsoft. And it was impossible to upgrade. There were no instructions. There's no store to buy this piece of software anymore. There's no disk. I couldn't download it because I kept getting an error message. I went to the technical support people. It took me about an hour and a half to find the phone number of the technical support people. I got put on hold twice for half an hour each. This is occurring over maybe a two-week period of time because I did not have a whole day or two to spend on this. And you can tell where my mind is spinning, the story that I'm beginning to create. I'm beginning to create this impersonal monopoly. Doesn't care about its customers. Doesn't care about whether I pay for the technical support or not. Bill Gates has $40.7 billion, and, you know, my 35 is not going to make a big difference. They don't give up, you know. They have mediocre products anyway. There was already the irritation of the experience, and the story was making me more and more angry. It was actually compounding and adding the suffering to the irritation that already was existing. But actually, okay, that's one level of the story. But as I looked into it deeper, there was another level of story that was actually triggering a lot more anger than I was aware of at first. And that is this feeling that I was doing the best that I could and I was still failing. This no-win situation. And this is a pattern in my life, that whenever I reach that point of doing my best and still failing, I get enraged. And this is a childhood thing, because as a kid, as an adult, I can understand no-win situations. I can accept them, I can rationalize them, but as a kid, I couldn't understand it. And when I was put in those situations, my response was, this is unfair, and it will always be unfair. So this is the second layer of story that I began to connect with. And what really fueled the increasing anger that I was experiencing over this piece of software. So it's really the identification with the story that provides the fuel for the fire. And mindfulness is really asking us, can we detach the fuel from the igniting spark? Because when there's a spark and no fuel, nothing happens. Mindfulness allows us not to feed an already unpleasant situation. But on the other hand, what I can do is I can choose to make the connection between my frustration and Bill Gates' $41 billion. Or I can choose to make the connection between my current frustration and my childhood injuries and thereby become more and more self-righteous in the moment. Or I can recognize that these stories are really creating a view that revolves just around me, that everything that Microsoft does revolves around me. And in that moment, begin to see sort of the absurdity of this. It really is, I mean, it's really a blessing that our practice gives, that we can wake up at any moment. We can wake up and see the absurdity to these stories in any moment, even if we begin to get caught. So by the time I got to the technical advisor, you can tell that I was a little bit on edge. I was already really impatient, and the way that he treated me was not to make any excuses, but he actually apologized without over-apologizing and then proceeded to take care of everything that I needed. He actually stayed on the phone for an hour with me. He actually couldn't solve the problem, so they eventually authorized that a disk be sent to me, and I still haven't received it yet. But it was interesting, because by that time, it was already too late, in the sense that after he had spent all that time with me, my internal experience had already changed. I had noticed that where I was in my story, I had also noticed how he was treating me and really connecting with his sense of care, with his sense of, I don't know if he had a practice of compassion or not, but it really felt that I was being taken care of. And in that moment, I was no longer angry. In fact, as I was telling my partner this whole story, and at the end of it, he said, I'm really sorry you had such a day. And I said, no, I actually had a great day. I feel great. And I think that was really, I can attribute that to this momentary look at what's happening right now and letting go of this story of doing my best and still failing, or letting go of the story that this mega corporation doesn't care about their customers. Often, in this incremental process of dealing with difficult emotions and things like anger, we expect to bring our whole practice into an event. We expect to try to be completely loving and compassionate and grateful. And in my experience, it's actually a little bit more subtle. Those high ideals are often really difficult to bring in the moment. So it's actually just a softening. It's just another way of looking at the story, as opposed to completely getting rid of the story, even by imposing, the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness or compassion, over it. It's really using the subtleties of our heart, this energy, as opposed to getting rid of our anger through imposing whether it's a quality of our mind or a quality of our heart on that. How do we apply this to things that really call deeply to our values and our beliefs? Things that aren't just a piece of software, but things that are happening in the world. The violence, things that we believe that are right or wrong, that often really touch these emotions of anger. And really is to notice whether the violence that we are so angry at is already inside of us, rather than being angry at the war in Iraq or hating injustice. Our practice invites us to just be with the anger and just with the hating. And in that experience of holding that anger and that hating without the content, there is that corrective experience of an unconditional acceptance of our moment. We may not get that unconditional acceptance from anybody else in our lives, but once we begin to give it to ourselves, we can more freely give it to others. So some of you may know this guy, Stephen Cope, who is, he does a lot in bringing yoga and Buddhism together. He's the scholar in residence at the Kripalu Yoga Center. And he asked 25 of us to write about how yoga and meditation has changed our lives. And he specifically asked me around how my meditation practice has influenced my experience with the difficult issues of oppression and racism in my life. And so I talk about in my chapter how mindfulness has been a support in these experiences, and I wanted to just read one passage from it. Last fall, I was rushing to meet a friend for dinner and had to get some cash from the ATM that I always use near my home in San Francisco. I waited impatiently and unmindfully for my turn, and when I reached to insert my card, I stopped abruptly. My awareness became sharp as a knife. Scratched into different areas of the ATM faceplate were the words Chinese garbage, Chinese trash, Chinese shit. The film of the scene I was living shifted into slow motion. Dinner plans became a sudden distraction, and my focus telescoped into what is happening right now? What is my internal experience? The rush of pressure to the back of my head, the pounding of the blood circulating through my body, and a dizziness and a detachment from the surroundings were immediately identifiable. As I turned in towards the detachment, I felt the aversion and the desire to escape, the anger, the wanting to push away the present moment. That which was, I didn't want to be. As I lifted the veil of aversion and anger, there was revealed a tremendous sadness that was felt by an 8-year-old boy who had his head in the clouds. I began to see the elderly Asian couples walking by me, barely supporting each other as my mother and father. I felt my heart embrace their experience and wonder what their responses might be to this disparagement of their identity. I saw others passing by as versions of myself or akin to me as brother or sister, and I felt their injuries. But I also felt the injury of the injurer, how the perpetrator must have been deeply wounded in order to create such a harmful event for others. From this deliberate expansion in examining my current experience came the realization that the 8-year-old boy relationship to such events had changed. And it was really the mindfulness practice that created enough space in an incident like that, which still happens in San Francisco, that it's not that I didn't do anything after that event. I mean, you know, there were people that I contacted and I felt good about that. But in the past, I would have moved into those conversations, you know, overwhelmed by rage. And moving into those experiences, contacting the bank or KRON, one of the local TV stations, moving from a place of peacefulness was a completely different experience. Martin Luther King wrote, "In struggling for human dignity, we must not allow ourselves to become bitter or indulge in hate campaigns. To retaliate with hate and bitterness would do nothing but intensify the hate in the world. Never succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter. As you press for justice, be sure to move with dignity and discipline, using only the instruments of love." And again, you know, these instruments of love can be subtle. They can be small. They're not necessarily bringing that high ideal of compassion or love if you don't feel it in the moment. It could just be that intention to work through it, that intention to see the larger picture, to see a story, to see beyond the story that I am caught in. One of the recent events that I was at was a rally after the Supreme Court stopped San Francisco from giving marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And if you haven't been around City Hall in San Francisco, it's just a really active place these days. There's a lot of joy and there's a lot of some anxiety. But these rallies, I was standing in the rally, and I just noticed how easy it would be to get caught in the anger of the politics. And even though I have some very strong beliefs around this issue, as I was standing there, I was just noticing where to direct my energy. Do I want to get caught in getting drawn into these feelings of righteousness, into these feelings of making other people wrong? Very easy to do on this issue. The you know, when we were training in the firefighting school, one of the most dangerous fires to fight is in what's called a box canyon. The canyon walls are so high that if the fire is in the canyon itself, it creates an updraft that it replicates a fireplace and a chimney. It just sucks the fire in, and the fire moves really quickly. And there are times in which I feel that unless I'm really mindful, I can get caught, regardless of my intentions of creating peace in my life. The updraft of the energy around me, of the anger around me, can throw me off. And just, it's an act of concentration, coming back to our original intentions of practice. So I'll just end with two things. One is, anger is a difficult topic, and I may, you know, in terms of bringing up these issues, they may or may not resonate with your own experience. They may bring up some strong feelings of, you know, relating or not relating to what I said. So really I invite you to notice all of those feelings right now and to just allow them to be there. Really, I don't ask you to believe anything that I say, but just to, from your own experience, whether any of it resonates with your experience, and just to leave the rest behind. The last thing that I feel important to say for me is that part of exploring all of our experience is acknowledging how human we all are, how imperfect we are on our way to awakening. And so it may seem as if I shouldn't do anything unless I get to a stage in which I purify my anger. But I don't know if our practice is asking us to do that. Rather, the invitation is constantly to look at our actions and our thoughts as to what is leading us towards more suffering versus what is leading us to less suffering. It's not asking us to do nothing until we become fully awake. So that even if we are creating suffering in our actions, whether it's being engaged in the world or not, is that suffering leading to more suffering, or is that suffering leading to less suffering? William Sloan Coffin was one of the chaplains at Yale University when in the 60s and 70s when the Vietnam War was at its height, and he was one of the few visible people in the clergy that spearheaded the draft resistance. And he said, "No man does anything in this world for one reason alone. If we wait for our motives to become pure, we will have a good excuse to do nothing." Thank you.
I just want to thank you. What you had to say resonated quite well with me.